fire. And we're talking about pandemics, not only the one that we're going through right now, but also ones that are earlier. And I know that in your writing, you mentioned a wonderful allegory that was given to us many centuries ago by Plato, the allegory of the cave. And I thought that it was such a good analogy of how we can think we know reality and we're not maybe looking as clearly as we possibly can. So I'd love for you to tell the story of the allegory of the cave.
Okay. Oh, wow. Plato. So the story is that there is a cave and people are sitting with their backs to a low wall and facing the back of the cave. And behind them are other people that are carrying objects and moving back and forth. And their shadows are lit from a huge fire that's burning at the mouth of the cave. And so what the people who have their backs against the wall are seeing are the shadows moving against the back wall of the cave. That's what they see. And they believe, because it's all they've ever seen, that that is reality. And at some point, one of those people stands up, we don't know why, and goes to the front of the cave. And it's quite frightening because very bright, never seen anything like this, fire so bright. And then beyond the fire, outside, even more light, so hard to see, hard to keep eyes open. And there's a fire in the sky that's even brighter. I mean, really hard to keep eyes open. But after a while, the person is able to look around and see color and three dimensions and living things and living people and a world that is alive, not just shadows on the back of the cave. And then the person thinks, should I go back? Should I tell people? And some doubt about whether or not to do that. But in the end, this person decides, I will try, and goes back into the cave and tries to tell the others. Perhaps not surprisingly, most of them don't want to hear anything about this outer world. It really don't want to know, some of them, and others are like, oh, that, who cares? It's not important. This is good enough for me. And so that is the dilemma of the person who has seen what's on the outside of the cave. Now, I'm not a philosopher, so I can't really make commentary as philosophers would. This is like the big story out of Plato's Republic, right? This huge, but in this pandemic, in this time of going down and going in, I think a lot of people have reevaluated their priorities and their values and, you know, what, as the poet Mary Oliver would say, what is it we plan to do with this one wild and precious life? They have changed. They've discovered that what they wanted before is not what they want now. And what was important before is not important now. And the world looks very different. And they're also discovering that there are some people that don't really want to wake up in that way. Or anyway, they don't want to change their perception. Maybe they are awake, but they don't want to change their perceptions. And that's how it is. It just is. But the person whose perception has changed can never unring that bell.
Right.
Because the outer world is there. And even if you go back into the cave, you can't ever forget that it was there.
Right, right. Well, I think of this analogy that it might have something to do with a lack of collective memory of one of the huge, huge plagues. It was the 1918 flu epidemic. And it happened, coincided with World War I, the war to end all wars. And there's just barely a collective memory of this. So please comment on that and its significance.
Yes, that is a terrible tragedy in a very odd way, a double way. So there was a war, and there was a flu. And the flu essentially ended the war because so many people were dying. The countries could not sustain the war. Far more people died of the flu than the war. But it was the war that held the headlines, and the flu was really a byline at that time. And afterwards, too. So the flu burned out. It started in March 1918. It was called originally the Spanish influenza because Spain was not involved in the war, and those were the only newspapers that reported on it. All the others were like, oh, no, we don't talk about that. We're busy fighting a war. But in fact, it started in Kansas, a Kansas chicken, and then a Kansas pig, and then a Kansas soldier, and then off it went. So we know, it came here from the U.S. of A. And then the flu burned out in 1920, but by then the war was over, and so it was forgotten. On a collective level, on a cultural level, no one mentioned it. And historians did notice that. They noticed there was kind of a lack of mention about the flu, but there was so much about the First World War. And then, of course, the Roaring Twenties, and then there was a big depression, and then there was a Second War. There was a lot going on, you know, in those decades. So, okay, fine. It wasn't until 1968 that this amazing historian, Alfred Crosby, was studying different death loss levels in soldiers around the country in the U.S. He was in actually Washington State University Library, and he started counting the dead. And he realized that the death counts from 1918 were astronomical. He knew there was a flu. We all knew it was a flu. But then he started actually counting. And as a good historian, he started communicating with other people, you know, census people. And it was he who first estimated in a book that he published in 76, actually, just really for kind of other historians, that 40 million people had died. Now that's been adjusted upward to between 50 and 100 million, which out of a billion people in the world is a huge number of people, right? A huge number. He was a historian who was very interested in the role of biological events as huge determinants in history. So he knew what this meant. Later, that book was republished during the AIDS epidemic when we had another virus that was killing people and not getting enough attention, and Cambridge University Press republished as America's Forgotten Pandemic. But it was still remarkable that no one in 50 years, well, really by the time his book came out, almost 60 years, had looked at that pandemic at all. And there were a couple of poems that were written. You know, Yeats wrote his Second Coming poem, you know, about the beast slouching to Bethlehem, you know, turning and turning in the widening gyre. The falcon cannot hear the falconer. I mean, there was despair. And Crosby, in his book, talks about how the recognition of that pandemic was on an atomic, an atomized level. Individuals grieved, but the culture didn't grieve. The culture didn't acknowledge the pandemic. And as a result, we might say, the culture just partied on at the end of the First World War and then fell into a terrible depression, which some people would say was not just economic, but emotional, spiritual depression, as people do when they're grieving.
We don't connect those 50
million
two.
People.
We don't connect.
No, we
them.
Don't.
Yeah.
No, we don't. No, we don't.
Well, so in today's pandemic, now we're in 2022 and on the precipice of 2023, and we have this conversation. Where are we? Do you see a collective grief, or are we in collective denial? What do you see in your estimation as you look at the past and look at the present?
That's a really good question, Justine. That's an excellent question. You were right earlier when you said it's easier to find meaning looking back in time, meaning for pandemic disease back than forward, obviously. I mean, I don't have a crystal ball, neither do you. I think at this point, it's a great mix there are people who acknowledge that we've lost over a million Americans, and those are the dead ones. So many people, we still not even beginning to calculate the long-term effects of COVID and what it does, increased likelihood of developing Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, things like Epstein-Barr, you know, many things. This virus doesn't just stop when the coughing stops. So we know that. And what it does in terms of the psychological damage done, I mean, we've seen this huge spike in kids and adults of anxiety. And now the insurance companies are saying, well, maybe anxiety is a disease. It's like, and depression and so forth. So it is showing its long-term effects. But have we really reckoned with it as a trauma? I'm not sure. That's a really good question. And of course, the 1 million Americans is like 6 million people in the world, but we're pretty sure it's much, many more than that. Have we really, do we ever fully comprehend a trauma when it's happening? That's another question psychologists debate, but I'm not sure that we have. Perhaps more than they did in 1918, because there isn't a global war right now, but there are a lot of other distractions. And what they didn't have then, and we do have now, is this tidal wave of information that just inundates us and distracts us. And it's like, oh, well, it's, there are a lot of people who's like, oh, no, there's, the pandemic is really over now. I don't have to wear a mask anymore. It's like, okay, well, the hospitals are filling up again on you, but whatever. So I think that that's an excellent question. Are we engaging this? Are we really reckoning with the emotional, cultural truth of this pandemic better than they did in 1918? Not sure. That's a good question. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's always the case. I mean, it may always have been the case that people have never really reckoned with the emotional consequences of pandemic disease. Just suffered, died, and moved on.
Well, that's certainly one of the questions. And I'm thinking also that, you know, the survivors of any pandemic, any of us who have had COVID or who know of people who have had COVID, we're still so ignorant of the total repercussions of this. And that's scary. That's scary. And I want to talk more about that in just one moment. But I want to remind our listeners, I'm here with Dr. Barbara Hort, and she is the author of Hollow Crown of Fire, A Discovery of Meaning in the Coronavirus Pandemic and Its Predecessors. If you want to know more about her work, you can go to her website, barbarahort.com, and she spells her last name H-O-R-T. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. I'm here with Dr. Barbara Hort, and we're talking about pandemics, the present pandemic and pandemics of the past. And I'm just reminded of one of the myths that you talk about in your writing, in your book, is the Icarus and Daedalus myth, and how I think especially when we talk about the time of that 1918, and even before that, in the 1300s, when the plague, bubonic plague, was so rampant in the world, how we leaned on science. We thought, okay, we can overcome this in a way, because our scientific knowledge is really great, and we're so good at inventing things, forgetting in some ways that nature itself has always been in charge. And I think we have this hubris that, oh, we can overcome all of this with our scientific knowledge. I'd love for you to say something about the Icarus myth and how it applies maybe even today in the way we view how we can get through all of this.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's like several different topics. Okay, let me just think for a minute. First of all, in the Black Plague, people thought that they could overcome the plague with prayer. So at that point, they were leaning on religion. And in fact, it was the Black Death that kind of broke the grip of the Roman Catholic Church that it had on Europe. At that time, it was a universal grip that it had. But when the nuns and the priests were dying faster than the regular people because they were caring for them, then it was clear that prayer wasn't working, that people were going to die anyway. So that didn't work. In 1918, they tried a lot of scientific things that they had at the time. Those also didn't work. Today, we're discovering that these wonderful, amazing vaccines they've saved many, many lives, but they're not perfect. Can you believe it? They haven't just like stopped the virus in its tracks, and now the virus keeps mutating, and how could it do that? People sort of insulted that, you know, they're mad at the vaccine makers because they couldn't fix everything. It wasn't a panacea. There's an environmentalist, famous environmentalist named Watson is his last name, who said, nature bats last. And one of the things that came out of the Black Death was the fact that naturism and the Renaissance rose again. So it was the notion that we are just on this transitory visit to being embodied, but really it's the spiritual life that counts. That ended really with the Black Death. It took 100 years, but it did diminish, and the respect, at least reverence for nature, the rise of the scientific method was a part of the consequence of the Black Death, that we were like, nature is very powerful. Maybe we should learn from nature. The reason we know what viruses are today is because of the 1918 flu. The scientists tried to say, well, what is this thing? It's not a bacterium. And then they finally found viruses, which of course made it possible for us to have these vaccines today. We will certainly learn more about vaccine and how viruses work and how disease works because of what we're living through now with the coronavirus. Also, how nature works when we are heavily populated in this world. What are the parameters of disease and contagion when we are 8 billion people strong on a planet that has never had that many people before? So with regard to nature, I think that one of the things that pandemic disease does is it refocuses us on how powerful nature is in the determination of our lives. And we, in this electronic age, we're like, oh, we can rise above. It's mind over matter. We can conquer nature. We've got this handled. We have computers now. It's like, that's not all, you know, that's not going to help when you've got these tiny, tiny little things that mutate, that have uncountable numbers, ancient history, and nothing else to do on their side. And they're just replicating and mutating, and that's all they do. They can outthink us in their own way. With regard to the Icarus-Daedalus myth, it's not a great, huge myth in Greek mythology, but in 1918, it was the first big war after the Industrial Revolution, a huge belief in the power of humankind to create wonderful machines like trains and cars and tanks and airplanes and all kinds of wonderful things. And now we're going to go kill people with our wonderful machines. We're very powerful, very proud of ourselves now. Rather like in the myth of Daedalus and Icarus, it had to do with Daedalus was a genius of an inventor, kind of like the Steve Jobs, Bill Gates of his time. And the king that he worked for got mad at him. So he locked him up in a very tall tower with his son Icarus, which is always not a good idea when you put really smart people in boxes and then expect them not to find a way out. And so Daedalus made these two sets of wings that he built like bird wings, and there were high winds at the top of the tower. And so he tried his out, and he realized they could fly with them. So he said to Icarus, just be careful. Don't go too close to the water, or the feathers will get wet, and don't go too close to the sun, or the wax that's holding them together will melt, and you'll fall down. So off they went. Okay, the first in the myth, the first two humans that ever flew, you could only imagine what that, for anybody hearing the story, must have been so amazing. And off they fly, and Icarus, young man, takes off, and up he goes, and he thinks, of course, he's a god, right? Because he has wings. And maybe he had a computer, too, like an iPhone, like the latest iPhone. Who knew what he thought? But anyway, he got too close to the sun. And before he knew it, his wings had fallen apart, and he plunges past his father and into the sea and drowns. That story is a tiny little myth, but it has endured through the ages. And sometimes people think that he was the one who had hubris, who defied the gods. But in point of fact, it was really Daedalus who made wings that he shouldn't have been making. But to me, I put it in the book for the 1918 flu as a story for that, because it is sort of what happens. Like, we're going to go to war with machines and we're going to conquer. And it's like, yeah, until nature came along and she brought the biggest gun of all. A virus. Which is a virus. And guess who won the war? Nature won the war.
Tiny.
And with a little pin bores through the castle wall and farewell, king. You know, again, it's the hollow crown of fire.
Barbara, I can't help but think that now this is maybe some tiny little thing, a little report out of the South Bay in south of San Francisco that's saying, oh, we're going to allow robots to have use of deadly force to combat crime. I couldn't help because I was right in the middle of your book, and I'm going like, wait a minute, you know, is this the story of Daedalus and Icarus here? Are we flying up to the sun with wings that are going to melt? It just takes me also to another quote that you so beautifully bring to us from Maya Angelou, and she says, "We delight in the beauty of the butterfly, but rarely admit the changes it has gone through to achieve that beauty." And I think of ourselves here in this, we are in culturally, worldwide, in that caterpillar state of liquefying. Everything is liquid right now, and it's not solid. And that's hard for us because we want to know, oh, what's the meaning and how is this going to turn out? So each of us is having to make a decision about how we're living our lives and making meaning in some way. And I'd love for you to give any comment you have in all of your studies and research.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things I've said about this book is that, and one of the things I try very hard not to do in the book is to make some declaration about meaning, like where is meaning? What I do is present the story like a good storyteller, hopefully, and then with all the different pieces, I trust that the story will offer the pieces that each reader needs to see in order to find their own meaning. That we find meaning, the meaning we need to see. We find the meaning that we need to find. And that's why it's a discovery. And I think that in our descents into darkness, in our liquefactions, in our transformations into butterflies, I mean, we're not all going to be the same butterfly. We're not all going to be the same person at the end of this pandemic. It doesn't turn us all into the same being, and that's wonderful. So what my book might say to one person will be very different from right. what it says to another person, just as the pandemic will have different effects on different people.
Exactly. And I just want to remind our listeners that Persephone went down to Hades and she brought back gifts. So we all can look at the gifts that we are discovering in our own lives and in those of our loved ones. Thank you so much for being with us. I've been with Dr. Barbara Hort, and she is the author of Hollow Crown of Fire, A Discovery of Meaning in the Coronavirus Pandemic and Its Predecessors. And if you want to know more about her work, go to her website, BarbaraHort.com, spelling her last name, H-O-R-T, BarbaraHort.com. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You've been listening to New Dimensions. This is program number 3778.
New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the Donate button. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts and find over 1,000 hours of audio dialogues in our searchable archive. New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in Santa Rosa, California, USA. Our executive producer is Justine Willis-Toms. Our post-production editor is Lou Judson. For over 4 decades, New Dimensions has been producing weekly conversations at the leading edge. We sincerely thank all of you who have supported us by being members of Friends of New Dimensions, as well as members of our affiliate stations. My name is Dan Drayson. On behalf of everyone at New Dimensions, whose endeavors make this program possible, I'm wishing you well. New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. To find out more about the program you've just heard, to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and our New Dimensions and New Dimensions Cafe podcasts, and to access thousands of other programs in the New Dimensions archive, please visit our website, newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org. Or call us at 707-468-5215. That's 707-468-5215. Please join us next time as we explore New Dimensions. New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hello, I'm Mark Gober, author of An End to Upside Down Contact. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about research of reported interactions with UFOs, aliens, and spirits.
Are you inspired? Do you want to be? Tune in to The Arts Edge with Annie Roach, Saturdays from 6 to 7 p.m. and hear stories of artists and educators, writers, painters, actors, people from all walks of life. Hear how people are making their lives happen. You can find us at CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby Mountain. We're at TELUS HD Channel 7014. or you can find us on the internet at www.cjsf.ca. Tune in to The Arts Edge and be inspired.
You're listening to CJS.